Beginning in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the Rain Report for the week of October 8, 2004. You can hear part 1 of this week's program about Fred Terman on rainreport.com for the balance of the week. I'm Norm Seeley, KI7UP. One of the technological heroes of World War II was Fred Terman, a ham who developed the radar countermeasures that made life miserable for both German and Japanese ground stations, while making bombing runs safer for Allied aircraft in both areas. But what happened to Fred Terman after the war? We continue Hap Holly, KC-9RP's interview with Stuart Gilmore, W1FK, an engineer, scientist, and author, whose article about Terman can be found in the October 2004 issue of CQ magazine.
Fred Terman had been chairman of the electrical engineering department at Stanford, and during the war, he was promoted to dean of engineering, and it was hoped he would come back in mid-44 and then early 45. It's a fact that many people thought the war was going to be over in 44. They forgot about, or they didn't forget about, but they learned about the Battle of the Bulge, and the war wasn't going to be over. Fred finally got to leave his radio research laboratory, as it was called, around Christmas 1945. So he came back to Stanford as dean of engineering. And he was dean of engineering clear up until 1959. But in 1955, he was also named provost of Stanford University. So he began to build up all the engineering departments as soon as he became dean of engineering. And then once he became provost in 1955, he worked with a very energetic president called Wally Stirling. And the two of them brought most of the other departments up to snuff. That is, beyond the sciences, they brought up the humanities and social sciences department. So Fred was an extremely effective administrator. He wasn't always the most popular guy on campus because he was able to say no. Administrators have to take tough decisions sometimes. Fred's fairly well known for talking about steeples of excellence. He wanted an institution to do things in which they were excellent and not do things in which they were mediocre or less. If you couldn't compete in some area, you had to make tough choices. Do we really want to be excellent in that, or do we just not want to do it? And he worked so hard himself and didn't settle for anything mediocre in his own life or in his own career. He was a great building force there. And he also wanted the West and the Bay Area particularly to develop their high-tech industry. And so he did all sorts of things to encourage people to come out there and join what became the Stanford Industrial Park, what they called it first, then the Stanford Research Park. He enticed or helped entice a number of companies from the East to come out and thus became the basis of Silicon Valley, which really started with electron tube manufacturers like iMac, which hams are familiar with, Itel McCulloch, in the 30s, and then Hewlett-Packard beginning just before the war. So after the war, the Bay Area already had unusual high-frequency special-purpose vacuum tubes, and then they had the beginnings of an instrument industry, and then avionics and stuff came along. And it didn't just come from there, because in Palo Alto during World War I, Leda Forrest worked there for a while at the Federal Telegraph, which during World War I made the biggest transmitters in the world. And put transmitters all over Europe for the U.S. Navy. So even back in World War I, Palo Alto was cutting-edge electronics for its day with ARC transmitters and stuff, you know, operating with 600-foot towers and 1,000-foot towers that they built in Paris and Corfu and Toulon in France, and they had contracts in Shanghai and stuff. So in a sense, Silicon Valley, let's go back to in 1910 when they started the boom of radio broadcasting. And I would say Silicon Valley next went into the iMac, Heinz and Kaufman, the company out there, vacuum tubes, special purpose ones that they could get around some of the patents of the RCA consortium. And then that turned into the growth of instrumentation and avionics and radar equipment and the Klystron. And the Klystron became Varian Associates. So the first UHF television stations, as well as the Dew-Line radar stations in the 50s, started having the Klystron tubes. And that sort of phased on into computers, and then ferrites, and then software, and, you know, whatever it is today. Fred made some money during his lifetime. He was a very careful investor. That didn't drive him. And Fred also was on various corporate boards, and he liked that, but that didn't drive him that much. As much as he wanted the West to become industrially up with the East, Fred loved the university he taught at, and he loved his students. He was driven by seeing his students succeed, and he had a model where they would succeed and go out and start their own companies. So they didn't have to go back east to work for GE. They would start their own companies, like Hewlett-Packard or Watkins Johnson or some other companies there. Those were the successful people, and then he hoped they would feed back to their alma mater, giving jobs to new students, and they would support their alma mater, and he had this cycle. And so he was really driven by love of his students and love of the university more than he was, I want to invent Silicon Valley or I want to make $100 million. That didn't drive him. What drove him was the chance to build things, he said, and particularly building the various labs he worked at and then building the university and building his students' careers. Popular item was that he was a, you know, sort of mean guy and whatnot. He was a very shy guy. He knew so much about everything that people were in awe of him. But he was socially somewhat of an introvert, unless he was around engineers or people that knew something about engineering and technology, and he could be a star of a show. He was very powerful in going into a group of businessmen and selling them on an idea. He was very powerful in selling the Stanford trustees on the two-mile linear accelerator. He was very powerful in saving several thousand acres of Stanford land for research and natural preserve rather than turning into housing developments. But at a cocktail party, I've been told by people who were closer to his age than I am, that he would stand in the corner with a weak gin and tonic, just nursing it away. He was just not the glad hand type of guy. But the late Ed Ginston, who was the head of the two-mile accelerator for a while and the chairman of the board of Varian Associates, said that in the late 30s, when he and others were graduate students, and I've talked to some of these guys who were Fred's students in those days, Fred would come in every day and sit up at the end of the day on the workbench and let his legs swing back and forth, and he'd talk about anything, how are things going there, and also during World War II at the radio research lab. People have told me he would come in and sort of bend over and see what you were doing, snooping around a little, and then he would give you suggestions without you really realizing he had given you a helpful suggestion, and then he would wander off. And I've had people tell me he always told others that they did it. He didn't take credit. Mike Villard, who was the real creator of a successful single sideband systems and got a number of patents on that, Mike invented the select eject filter back in the old days, and Mike was a early specialist on media radar, and Mike's greatest contribution was over-the-horizon radar work in the 60s. Mike had long been a ham, and he told me that when he arrived at Stanford in 1938 and took over the Einesfreak sounding transmitter, that during his years knowing Terman, it is his younger years, he knew Terman had given him ideas that were valuable, but Terman never took credit for it, always told people it was Villard's ideas. And so Terman was beloved by students who knew him. He was so proud of Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard. He was very proud of Joe Pettit, a ham who later became president of Georgia Tech. He was very proud of Mike Villard with all of Villard's inventions and stuff. And that's where I think he got his real ego satisfaction.
You're listening to the conclusion of an interview Hap Holly, KC9RP, conducted with engineer, scientist, and author Stuart Gilmore, W1FK, about his article and new book about the father of Silicon Valley and radar pioneer Fred Terman. We'll be right back. This is the RAIN Report.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for RAIN audio.
I calculated from Fred's bills and everything else that during his life at Stanford, where he began teaching in 1925, until he had to retire in 1965, in those days when he was 65, he gave an amount equal to his university salary back to the university. So if you integrate over all those years what he gave back, he gave his salary back. And he gave much of the royalties of his textbooks and stuff back to the university. So my book, any royalties go to graduate engineering fellowships at Stanford. It's a little bit in the spirit of what Fred would have done.
Good for you. Backtracking a little bit. Since he was involved with Stanford when the Korean War came around, do you know whether or not he yearned to be back in doing more countermeasure work for that police action?
Fred had a huge buildup of microwave radar and also lower frequency backscatter radar and stuff during the early 50s. And Fred, at the time, privately revealed to the president of Stanford about 1952, he said, "Don't let this out, but the Office of Naval Research has said we're just about the most useful of any electronic center to the Navy." All sorts of work was going on in radar. During the International Geophysical Year in 57-58, around the globe, people did backscatter research, and they used three-element ham antennas, the ham bands, basically, 20 meters, 15 meters, and 10 meters, or 20 meters, 10 meters, and 6 meters. And these worked on a schedule the same all around the world, and these antennas would rotate and would send out pulses and then record a backscatter. Now, that was for geophysical knowledge. The use of radar backscatter at lower frequencies was developed particularly at Stanford all during those years, and eventually knowledge about it gained by Mike Villard and others allowed you to see 3,000 miles away and not just 30 or 40 or 50 or 100 miles like the radar in World War II. During the 50s, particularly the Navy, but also the Air Force Office of Scientific Research had stuff going on at Stanford in the electrical engineering departments and some of the other departments. And Fred, as dean of engineering, was the driving force.
What about Vietnam?
Well, Fred retired in 1965. What Fred did as soon as he retired was he became the shadow dean of engineering at Southern Methodist University. And for 8 years, he was the director of engineering and whatnot. His job was to set up and bring vastly improve SMU's engineering school. And he did that, and he gave back half his salary there. Then at the same time, he had been advising some Asian countries, particularly Taiwan and South Korea, on how to develop a modern engineering school. And during those years, he went all over the U.S. and on something like over 20 states. He made assessments of the state of California, the state of Florida, Massachusetts. He did particular schools as well as state systems, give a report on what was wrong with their engineering schools, where they were going in the wrong direction, what they should be doing, the kind of engineers that we needed, inefficiency in the way courses were taught. So you had to retire at age 65 in those days. So for about the next 8 years, Fred became president of some scientific organizations and spent his time advising others on how to set up engineering education. But in South Korea, Fred advised on the setup of sort of South Korea's MIT. It's called the KAIS, Korean Advanced Institute of Science, and that later became KAIST, Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology. And that's a school now with several thousand students that was set up in the mid-70s, and Fred advised them for several years on just how they should go about putting together a modern engineering school and the things that they should be trying to do rather than having 100 schools, each with about 6 students per class. You just were wasting your time. So he's somewhat of a hero in South Korea. And he went over and looked at Russia, the Soviet Union in those days, and came back. He said, don't worry, they're doing different things than we are. They have a different economy and society, so don't worry that they've got 10 times as many engineers as we have. They've got people that are doing such specialized stuff, they're not very flexible. And what engineers should be doing in the 60s and 70s, we need more PhDs. We don't need floods of people at the BA level. We should be improving our higher degree engineers. Fred was always a sort of quality rather than quantity guy.
What year did he pass on?
1982. He died just before Christmas. He was really rather ill physically his last 4 or 5 years, but I've seen his notes up until about a year before he died, and I've talked with an archivist who worked with him for a couple of years. In fact, it's a historian with a PhD, Rocky Nyland, who edited my text. She agrees with me. He was sharp as a tack up until he had some strokes and he was 80 and 81. He had the workaholic. He worked away. He still sent letters. And I've read his analysis of various parts of his 100 feet of papers that he gave to Stanford University, all his records. And I would read his 2-page typed analysis of, say, a box that was 2 feet deep of stuff. And he would nail it right. It was a beautiful summary of what was in that box. So he was a sharp guy until very near the end.
Did he have family?
He has 3 sons. 2 studied physics. The youngest one got a BA in physics and stayed on at Stanford for his PhD. Lou, the youngest Terman, went to IBM soon after he got his PhD, and Lou's a member of the National Academy of Engineering and is now retired from IBM and lives near Poughkeepsie. So he had 3 kids. His wife, Sybil, was a real stemwinder. You can read that in my book. Fred was a typical engineer. He made the real faux pas suggesting that they go on their honeymoon to an electrical engineer convention in Denver. And he said, Sybil, you'll only be apart from me for a few days, but they have programs for the ladies. Fortunately for the male reader, Sybil's written response to him was not kept. We don't have it. But he never mentioned that crazy idea again of spending his honeymoon at an engineer's convention. His wife, Sybil, was a psychologist who published a book on reading when she was in her 50s, and she was very interested in child education, as was Fred's father, the famous IQ psychologist, Lewis Terman. The Stanford-Binet IQ tests are really developed by Fred's father back around 1910. So the apples didn't fall too far from the tree in Fred's case. The desire to measure things quantitatively, the desire to see quality over quantity and stuff are some things Fred, either genetically or as in child environmental, he got from his father. He was certainly active as a ham from his early teenage years through his early 30s, and he became very interested in the history of radio and electronics once he retired.
That concludes Hap Holly, KC9RP's interview with engineer, scientist, and author Stuart Gilmore, W1FK, whose article about Fred Terman appears in the October 2004 issue of CQ Magazine. His book, entitled Fred Terman at Stanford, was released by Stanford University Press in mid-September, with all royalties going to Stanford University's engineering program. Incidentally, Fred Terman founded the Stanford Amateur Radio Club, whose call, W6YX, is a familiar call to DXers around the world today. Part one of the preceding interview can be heard for the balance of the week on RainReport.com, thanks to the audio bandwidth being underwritten by CQ Communications. The Rain Report is copyright 2004. Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Norm Seeley, KI7UP.